Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shape their lives and their careers. Every so often, an unconventional artist manages to steer their path into the mainstream and change the way that people regard rock stars. They then use their influence to help widen popular culture from that point onwards. Peter Gabriel is one of those rare musicians.
Hey, monkey.
In an in-depth interview here, Peter talks about the remarkable path his career has taken. Starting off with his earliest musical influences, he talks about his time with hugely loved 70s prog rockers Genesis, where he introduced new levels of theatricality into the rock world, and then onto his own idiosyncratic solo career, from its avant-garde beginnings through to his world-conquering So album and massive groundbreaking hits like Sledgehammer. He also chats with typical passion and surprising self-deprecation about launching the WOMAD Festival, his championing of world music, his renowned political campaigning, and his ambitions for the future. But I started by asking Peter, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, my mum's family were all musical, so Christmases, you know, was full of songs and different people playing piano particularly, but other instruments. And my mum, well, still plays buttons and bows, and that was probably the first melody. Something like that. And but it's that's probably not the chorus, but anyway.
East is east and west is west, and the wrong one I have chose. Oh, let's go where I'll keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows, rings and things and buttons and bows.
So, yeah, I think I grew up around music, and then church music, I think, had a significant impact. You know, I loved some hymns, not all of them, but when they were good, they were fantastic. And I remember at school, you used to scream your heart out, you know, with the right hymns. It was also a hippie time for me later on, and I would come into the chapel with my bells hidden under my trousers. But that was my musical accompaniment skill.
So where did you find music that belonged to you, that wasn't your parents' music or church music, but something that you identified with?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are key moments, you know, when you remember hearing something for the first time. And I was in the back of my parents' car when I heard Love Me Do.
Classic.
Beatles. Yeah, and it just, you know, these were days of very smooth music, and this sounded far more radical and revolutionary than punk did in its day. You know, it was rough and raw and exciting. And I was Beatles obsessed from then on. So the first record I ever bought was with the Beatles. And that was as probably as exciting as it ever got.
From then it was just a very good...
Downhill, yeah.
Love, love me do. Love me do. Whoa, love me do. Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please love me do. Love me do.
So when did you start thinking about music, not just in terms of this is something I love, but in terms of this is something that I could do myself?
Well, I guess the other thing I should say is that having grown up in a what then, I don't think now, was a quite a repressive educational system, that going down, there was a snooker room, you know, which was a sort of, this was a public school, and there was a very antiquated record player there. But that was such a release, you know. I would put on Otis Redding and John Mayle, blues records, soul records, and, you know, there were a few of us that would just zone out. And it was really a sort of major emotional release, I think. I loved drums, you know, as a small boy. I got very excited when we went to a hotel and there was a band playing, and I would sit, you know, behind the drummer in awe, thinking, you know, one day I will make more noise. And because it was physical, you know, and you could hit things, and sometimes they sounded good. So I remember the first drum I bought was an old Tom Tom, but to show how old I am, it had leather heads. And it was, I bought it off Andrew Ramage's brother, and it was £7. And I was as happy as a kid in a sandbox. And I could hit it pretty hard, although I did discover, to my great disappointment, that leather can break.
Yeah.
And but I still, to this day, love the sound of leather skins, and a trademark sound in my later recordings was a Brazilian surdo drum, which I used to get the leather heads from Brazil, because they would sound so different from the artificial modern head that we now take for granted.
So what was your first gig? Because you saw Otis Redding, didn't you? You saw Otis Redding live.
Yeah, and I can't remember. I don't think it was my first gig, but it was the first one that blew me away entirely. And I think still to this day is the best gig I've ever seen in my life. I was 17 years old and went with this girl I had a crush on to the Ram Jam Club in Brixton. And I think there were maybe less than 10 other white faces there. And he came on, and it was just one of those extraordinary moments when the sun comes out and this superlative performer. I mean, I remember reading a bit, you know, from Bill Graham, who's seen a lot of performers at his time, and he said, no one but no one compared to Otis. And anyone that was lucky enough to see him do his thing when the band were firing, and what a great band, you know, it was unbeatable.
La Digue. Oh, she may be weary. Them young girls, they do get weary wearing that same old miniskirt dress. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when she gets weary, you try your little tenderness. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, man, I know she's waiting, just anticipating the thing that you'll never, never, never possess. No, no, no. But while she's there waiting, just a little bit of tenderness, that's all you got to do. Now it might be a little bit sentimental, no, but she has her griefs and cares. Yeah, 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 yeah. But the soft words, they are spoke so gentle. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it makes it easier to bear. Oh, she won't regret it, no, no. Young girls, they don't forget it. Love is their home.
madness, yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's all so easy. All you got to do is try, try a little tenderness, yeah. Damn that heart. All you got to do is know how to love her. You got to hold her, squeeze her, never leave her. Now get to her, got to just try a little tenderness, yeah, yeah. Lord have mercy now. All you got to do is take my advice. You got to hold her, don't squeeze her, never leave her. You got to hold her and love her. So you got to try a little tenderness, a little tenderness, a little tenderness.
So your first ever release was a single, which was with Genesis, wasn't it?
First release, and was a track called The Silent Sun. The excitement of seeing our name in print in the record mirror, and it was actually, I think it had the lowest circulation, which is why Decca could afford the ads, and it was only in an ad, but just to see it there was blew us away.
The silent sun that never shines. She is the warmth of my lonely heart. The motion of a turning wheel. Can't you stop it and look around?
Baby, you feel so close. I wish you could see my
we were definitely naive, but there was a passion for songwriting. You know, we had dreams at that time of just being songwriters, not bothering with all this, you know, silly performing stuff. And with lots of artists recording our songs. And, of course, not one artist was really interested. I think there was an Italian female singer who recorded one song early on, but she was certainly the exception. So we realised pretty soon the only way we could get our songs recorded was to play them ourselves. And then, of course, they became uncoverable anyway, so...
So how do you feel about those Genesis recordings these days? Because people are still so passionate about the band, people love them so much, would love them to reform.
Well, I have my favourites within that period, you know, things like Supper's Ready or Lamb Lies Down, and not all of it, but there were moments that really felt they connected. And they're clearly the work of young people, but there's still, you know, a passion and a charm sometimes, if you like that sort of thing. And I'm well aware that a lot of people don't.
finds a focus in its face. Somehow it's lying there, brings a stillness to the air. Though man-made light at night is very bright, there's no whitewashed victim as the neons dim to the code of white.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Peter Gabriel. And just before, you heard the title track from Genesis' 1974 album, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. Now, Peter's first solo single and his first hit was Salisbury Hill in 1977, taken from his eponymously titled first album, which is out the same year. I asked him about recording what would become that classic track.
As an ex-failed drummer, it's still rhythm that hooks me into lots of tracks, and even though it's a folky thing, it's still got a nice rhythm to it, and some beautiful acoustic playing from Steve Hunter, and that was the sort of attractive track from the first record that actually got me on the radio, and at that time I was very conscious of avoiding the sort of Genesis area of music with which I'd been associated, because I didn't want to do sort of son of.
It also set this tone of being accessible as a piece of pop music, but also very experimental, something that lots of artists kind of aspire to, but not many managed to achieve, sort of setting the tone for the career that followed.
Well, I think we were lucky, and Bob Ezrin was producing that, and, you know, he, I think, had a good idea, and he, in fact, was the man who introduced me to Tony Levin.
Hmm.
There were some funny moments, though, because, you know, I still wanted the sort of experimental side of things, and so invited Robert Fripp to the session, and one of his, I thought, very beautiful solos was mysteriously wiped, and it made me very angry at the time. But these were days when you had 16 tracks, and so everything was at a premium, but it was a criminal act, in my opinion, but it was one way that I think Bob saw of finishing an argument about.
just
we'll wipe it. I don't think he's ever admitted that, but I need to ask him again.
Voice.
was Salisbury Hill from 1977, the first hit single by my guest on the first time this week, Mr. Peter Gabriel.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome back to the first time here on Six Music, the series where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Peter Gabriel, and that was Games Without Frontiers, Peter's first UK top 10 single from 1980. Peter is also famous for helping popularise world music in the UK, and he was also a driving force behind setting up the first WOMAD World Music and Arts Festival. In fact, he's still closely tied to the annual event. I asked him when he was first drawn to what would become known as world music.
Well, I remember it when I had left the music business. You know, I left Genesis and thought I was going to do something else entirely, and didn't really find anything better.
So, what else did you try?
Well, gardening and making babies, both planting seed. But however, you know, I was a little disillusioned with the business, and in fact, you know, in a way, the success that we'd sought was a prison in some ways. And, you know, the more successful you got, the more you'd know where you were going to be 2 years from now. And it was, I mean, there were a whole variety of reasons why it sort of ground to a halt. But I was in the countryside, and I had a shortwave radio. One of the things I noticed, which you'll find in the lyric of Here Comes the Flood, is that as the night came down, the radio waves would appear miraculously on shortwave, because you couldn't get a very good signal in daylight. I don't know why.
That's very romantic. I like that.
Yeah. Well, it was something about the darkness and the space and the emptiness of the darkness, allowing things to happen that don't happen in the busyness of daylight. And that's stuck with me. Anyway, I would explore these many, many stations, and there was one Dutch radio station that played some interesting stuff, and it had been playing the soundtrack of, I don't think, a very remarkable film, but it was a Stanley Baker African epic called Dingaka. Or maybe that was the name of the track and not the film. I can't remember. But it was something where the rhythms and the voices stuck out for me, and I thought, oh, there's something I should explore here. And that was a sort of moment. But then I found a few other people that were similarly getting interested in sounds of other countries and players and incredible singers from other countries. And it was so hard to find. You know, there were maybe two record stores that we knew of in London that carried this sort of material. And, you know, except for cultural events, festivals, it was virtually impossible to see a lot of these artists. So I propose we started to try and get a festival together that would allow us to feature a lot of these extraordinary players, singers, writers, drummers, and that became WOMAD.
The first one was 1982?
82, so I was hustling in 80, but it took a couple of years to mature.
Who was on the bill?
It started with the Burundi drummers, but we had a strange mix of people like Echo and the Bunnymen, Simple Minds, John Hassell. But we had the Sabri brothers, I think, who were Qawwali singers. But it was sort of more a mix of world music, indie, and then we had some of these fantastic musicians going into schools and working on building instruments and masks. And it felt a little different from the other festivals. I mean, now sort of family-orientated multicultural festivals are very
trendy.
Very trendy, very common, but at that time it wasn't.
When did you first become politicised, do you think? Because your lyrics, your work with Amnesty, with the Labour Party, and obviously songs like Biko are hugely political, but as a person, when did it first become a concern for you? Because it's a very difficult thing for musicians, but it's a very easy thing for musicians to get wrong, bringing politics into their art.
I think the Amnesty tours were things that were life-changing experiences for all the artists. And there were two of those, one in America, which sort of U2 had fronted and hustled people, and then this Human Rights Now tour, which I hustled people and managed to get Bruce Springsteen to come in and front. We had Sting and Yusu, Tracy Chapman, and but we went around a lot of places, and I think that invitation had come partly from doing some Amnesty benefits before and also from writing the Biko song. So in a way, that was a moment when I was sort of feeling my way into writing material, you know, about the real world. And your very own Tom Robinson I knew at the time, and he was very good in encouraging me because I thought this isn't going to get taken seriously coming from me. And he said, actually, you know, if attention and money move in the right direction, who cares? You know, and it was good advice. And actually that song in many ways, you know, changed all sorts of things for me. And I think, you know, connected me in a more direct physical way, and then led to creation of this thing called witness.org, which used cameras for human rights. And now, you know, probably about a third of my work time is related to these sort of activities.
Because
We have to talk about So, the album in 1986 that made you a huge international star. When you first started making it, were your first intentions to make something that would connect with people immediately?
Yeah, I think everyone thinks, you know, oh, you must have known that Sledgehammer was a hit. And we recorded the album, and then Tony reminded me of this. He said they were actually on the way home. The taxi was booked, and I think on the way to pick him up. And I said, well, there is this one other thing I've got, which maybe we could try and just see if we can get something happening. And that was Sledgehammer. So it was very much an afterthought. But we knew there that there was a hell of a groove and there was something cooking. It took a little while to milk it, but we got there. I think, you know, the only thing that I was conscious of at the time as a sort of concession to a more commercial approach was Gail, who was my manager at that time, persuaded me, you know, you're always hiding behind your album sleeves. You know, why not have one and get a nice photo on the front? And we did that. And, you know, we actually had women in the audience, which was a wonderful...
That's what I put in my notes. I put down your face, because for years and years on album covers and videos, you were obscured. Now your face was absolutely everywhere and you're recognised everywhere and you lose a certain amount of privacy.
Yeah, but then you soon get old, bald and fat and you don't look anything like the pictures. Well, it was my pop star moment, you know, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
You enjoyed it?
Yes, no, definitely. I think it's a great thing for everyone to be a pop star for a short period only, because it's just dangerous if you start believing it or living there.
Kate Bush is someone you've worked with many times, firstly on Games Without Frontiers, but maybe, and most memorably, on the song Don't Give Up off the So album. When did you first meet her?
I can't remember. There was a drummer called Preston Heyman who was working with her live band. I don't know if that was the connection. I think I remember hearing Wuthering Heights and thinking, that's very interesting.
The record doesn't sound like any other
anyone else. Been yeah. So, and then when I came to do Don't Give Up, in fact, because it was set in America and related to depression, Dolly Parton had been the first thought. I think, in a strange way, I think it would have, and she wasn't interested at the time, but she ended up asking me to do it on her TV program, but it was when I was touring and couldn't do it. But that, I mean, I'm a big Dolly fan, but it would have been a very different sort of thing, you know, a bit more country animal probably. Then when I was sort of moving back towards our fairer shores, you know, I was thinking it needed a voice that was nourishing and maybe had some frailties to it, and was a beautiful thing, and Kate was an obvious choice, and I didn't know if she'd be interested to do it. And she came down and was very nervous at first, and then came down a second time and absolutely nailed it. And, you know, that song particularly has had extraordinary stories of sort of stopping all sorts of people, including quite a few well-known people, apparently stopping them killing themselves. And I think it is, you know, very much down to this sort of reassurance and feeling of love that you get from Kate's voice.
In this proud land we grew up strong. We were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name. But no one wants you when you lose.
Bits of stuff that are in the can, and was probably I did a couple of songs for films just recently. One was with a wonderful Pakistani singer called Atif Aslan, who's been up to now more of a sort of Bollywood artist, but he has the potential, I think, of crossing over to a very big audience. And I've just done another one for this Mexican director called Guillermo Arriaga, who was the writer on things such as 21 Grams and Babel.
Is there a desire to release your own?
Some more records.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, the trouble is I now, because I have kids again, I want proper family life. In previous lives, you know, I've been a workaholic musician, as many are. I'm trying not to do that, and I do now some technology stuff and this benefit stuff and music. There's a little less time for it, but I will carry on writing songs until I drop. You know, it's always been a passion, and there's a lot more for me to learn.
So after all these firsts, you get to pick the last song. What shall we play?
Well, I could finish where I began with Otis. And Change Gonna Come. It's thoroughly miserable and thoroughly hopeful. which maybe works for me too.
River, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know change has got to come now. Ooh, yes it is. I don't know what's up there beyond the clouds. It's been a long time coming. I know change has gotta come. Oh yes it is. There's a time I will go to my brother.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Expert to back don't want nobody to know.
Is a repeat.
Take me for I'm authentic, can you feel it?